A couple of weeks ago when I gave the sermon, I gave you a challenge about the sermon was on the fear of God, and I gave you a challenge to see if you could determine whose name was associated with the fear of God. How many of you have figured that out? I had one person really grilling me for day after day, asking me questions. Well, what about this? And asking for parameters and things like that. So, and then she's not here today. So anyway, we hopefully she's able to tune in on the internet. But before we, I give you the answer to that, in determining, I'd like to ask you a few questions. Apart from Jesus Christ, which biblical character has the most written about them? Probably the biblical character that has the most written about them is Abraham. And number two is probably Jacob. And there's quite a bit written about Joseph and Moses and David. But which of the significant biblical personalities has the least written about him? That would be Isaac. He's not mentioned as often in the scriptures, but as you'll see in the sermon today, Isaac was a great man. Interestingly, Isaac lived a long life. He lived 180 years, and he lived longer than his father Abraham. Abraham died at 175 years of age, Jacob at 147, Moses at 120, Joseph at 110, and David at 70. And when David reached 70, he was a worn-out old guy. He had seen a lot of life, and so he was very worn out. And long life indicates God's pleasure with a person by granting you that long life. And it gives us an indication that Isaac was doing some things that were right. As you look at Isaac, he's not an individual who founded a nation. He commanded no great armies. He was not a great statesman. He was not used by God to write a book of the Bible. He wasn't a king or priest. His occupation seems to be that of a trader and a shepherd, although a wealthy one. And in the story flow of Genesis, Isaac seems to be overshadowed by his father, by his son's son Jacob, and by his grandson Joseph. But interestingly, there's a remarkable aspect of his life that sometimes we don't think about. He was the only one of the patriarchs that was married to one woman and one woman only. He didn't have multiple wives. He had one wife and one wife only. And that may be an indication of some of the greatness of the man. Now, certain biblical characters display various characteristics of God and Jesus Christ. For instance, as you examine the scriptures, you find that Abraham is a type of the Father. And Isaac is a type of the Son of God, type of Jesus Christ. We know that he portrayed the Lamb of God when Abraham sought to, he was requested by God to sacrifice his son. He was a type of Jesus Christ. And in other ways, as we'll see as we go through the sermon, he was a type of Jesus Christ. As you look at Jacob, he portrays the flawed and overcoming Christian. And his life zigzags all over from being kind of a scoundrel to repentance and getting his life on track. Joseph is Christ as the righteous one, the bringer of prosperity. Moses is a type of Christ the lawgiver and David as the conquering king. And as we look at Isaac, we will find that Isaac, in a major way, was a type of Jesus Christ. Now, one of the things that gives us a clue about Isaac is his name. His name is Isaac. How many of you know what Isaac's name means? Okay, some of you may, some of you may not. But let's look at how his name came to be. Let's go to Genesis chapter 17. Genesis chapter 17, and God gave the son of Abraham this name. And God names people based upon certain characteristics that they've developed. And this name that God gave to the son of Abraham was a name that indicated certain things about this man. Genesis chapter 17, verse 15. Then God said to Abraham, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be from her." Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, "Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?" And Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael..." So he's telling him here that he's going to have a child. He'd been expecting one for a long time, and it hadn't worked out. He already had a child by Hagar, the handmaid. And so he mentions that child here, beginning in verse 18. He says, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Oh, that Ishmael might be the one that you would choose to work through." Then God said, "No, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. She'll call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his descendants after him." And he goes on to say here that he will bless Ishmael, which reassured Abraham, but God said, "I'm not going to work through Abraham or through Ishmael. I'm going to work through your son, Isaac." Now let's go to chapter 18, verse 9. So we see Abraham laughed. Abraham laughed. Verse 9. Then they said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" So he said, "Here in the tent." So Sarah was not in exactly the same part of the tent as Christ and the angels and Abraham were. So you couldn't see Sarah, but she was in the tent. And he said, "I will certainly return to you according to your time of life, and behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son." Sarah was listening in the tent door and was behind him. So she's listening, but you can't see her. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, "After I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord, being old also?" She didn't laugh out loud. She laughed to herself. So there was no sound, but she laughed to herself. And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I bear a child since I am old?'" So even though the tent was blocking the view of Jesus Christ, he knew what was in her heart. "Is there anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son." But Sarah denied it, saying, "I did not laugh," for she was afraid. And he said, "No, but you did laugh." So Abraham laughed and Sarah laughed. But there was a different vantage point that each of them was coming at this with. Sarah laughed within herself or to herself. And Abraham laughed just out loud. The wording of the Hebrew gives the impression of an exuberant laugh, whereas Sarah's laughter was hidden. In Romans chapter 4, verse 17, gives us some insight into what Abraham's thinking was at the time when Christ announced that he would have a child. Romans chapter 4, verse 17. Romans chapter 4, verse 17. So this speaks about the faith of Abraham. And in verse 17 it says, "As it is written, 'I have made you a father of nations.' In the presence of him whom he believed, God, who gives life to the dead and calls those things which do not exist as though they did, who contrary to hope, in hope believe so that he became the father of many nations, according to what was spoken, so shall your descendants be. And not being weak in faith, he did not consider his own body, although dead, since he was about 100 years old, in the deadness of Sarah's womb. You know, from a human perspective, there's no hope of a child. But God said, now's the time, you will have a child. He did not waver at the promise, so Abraham did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God and being fully convinced that what he had promised he was also able to perform, and therefore it was accounted to him for righteousness. God told him, you will have a child. And Abraham had wanted this for years and years. And finally it was to come to pass, and he laughed in exuberance, thrilled that this was finally going to come to pass. And so God recognized this. He believed that God was making a promise, and God had the ability and the power to overwhelm anything that was against it. So if God said it, it was going to be done. And he could count on that. That's why God said it was accounted to him for righteousness. He believed God. He believed God said something, and he believed that God would accomplish what he said would be done. Now, what Abraham said early in chapter 18 about Ishmael, that he might live before you, is really a sorrowful lament for Ishmael, because once Abraham has a child of his own through Sarah, then Ishmael's out as the head of the family. That's just how it worked. But Abraham knew, even though Ishmael at the time was only 12, that Ishmael was not living in a godly manner. He could tell that he's not going in the right direction. And he could see that if Ishmael stayed on that path, it would not work out well. So Abraham looked at this, and because of his love for Ishmael, he wished that Ishmael might turn in the right direction. But God said, sorry, he's not the person I'm going to work with. I'm going to work with the son of promise, who is Isaac. By way of contrast, Sarah laughed and then denied it. She did it within herself. And it was a laugh of incredulity, a laugh of disbelief. Otherwise, she would not have denied that she had laughed. So God looks on the heart, and so she may have denied it, but he knew what was in her heart. He knew that she didn't believe it. In fact, God coming and announcing that you're going to have a child, she considered to be ridiculous. That's how she thought of it at the moment. Now, let's go to Hebrews chapter 11. So it kind of leaves us thinking, well, I guess Sarah really didn't have the faith that Abraham did. Well, at the moment she didn't. But look at what it tells us in Hebrews 11, verse 11. It says, by faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. So, yes, she had laughed. Yes, she had considered it ridiculous, but she repented and she showed her faith. So the promise of God was shared by both Abraham and Sarah, and they both believed that God would accomplish what he said he would do. So immediately after Abraham's reaction in Genesis chapter 17, verse 19, God told him what the name was going to be, which was Isaac. And so Isaac means laughing, in the sense of something that is continuous. And this tended to be his personality, a laughing, positive personality. Or he laughed, something that went on in the past. And I think that as you look at both of these definitions, they apply to this man, Isaac. He laughed looking back on Abraham's initial reaction and laughing, and it might, as I say, give us some insight into the way that Isaac was. Normally, laughter is associated with good times, with happiness. We all enjoy being around somebody that's happy and jovial. And that's the way Isaac was. That's the way he was in his life. Now, the Bible gives us enough insight into Isaac so that we can see his wisdom and his general disposition. How did he handle things? How did he handle things? And why is his name associated with the fear of God? Let's think about one of the challenges that Isaac had to deal with, and that is having a father who was a great man. He had a father who was a great man. You know, as you think about Abraham, Abraham was a person who comes along very rarely, probably the only one in the history of the world that acted in faith as he did. He was a unique individual, a larger-than-life individual. And you've grown up in his household. And you have to everybody's going to compare you with the greatness of your father. And people tend, and boys tend to either want to do things to excel their father or to reject their father and go in the opposite direction. And so it's a hard thing to deal with as a young man. As I said, Abraham's impact was worldwide. He impacted the world in which he lived, from the Tigris-Euphrates Valley all the way to Egypt, because he lived in all those places. And Abraham's life spanned the entire area. He had an impact on many different people. He was a larger-than-life personality who was seems able to do almost everything. He was a trader. He was a sheep herder. He was able to put together an army and go to war. He dealt with his family. He interacted directly with God, challenging him on the issue of Sodom and Gomorrah. In contrast, you know, whereas Abraham is so large, when you look at Isaac, he's pretty small. He's nowhere near the personality that Abraham was. Everything is basically small, and the Bible records only once did Isaac leave his place of birth. Only once. He thought of going down to Egypt in time of famine, but as far as areas where he needed to improve, there was the big problem that he had by denying that Rebekah was his wife, which we'll see here a little later. So how often do we read of the sons of great men living up to the greatness of their father? As you think about Isaac's sons, Jacob and Esau, did they live up to their father's high standard? Esau was a scoundrel, and Jacob was a scoundrel too until he came to repentance. What about, assuming Isaac was a great man, neither of these sons lived up to the father. How about Moses? What about his sons? They didn't live up to Moses' high standard. What about Samuel? He was a pretty great man. Were his sons as great? No, basically they were common criminals. What about David? What about David? What about his sons? They killed one another, they rebelled, and Solomon was not a David. What kind of challenge would it be to Isaac to grow up in the household of Abraham? In the household of one of the greatest men in history, a righteous man, and it posed a great challenge for him. Many would try to excel their father, to live up to their father or down. But, you know, again, you can see where Isaac was a type of Christ. Because as you think about Christ coming into the world, what did Christ do? Did he try to live up to his father? Did he come to the end of the world and try to challenge his father and supersede his father in some way? No, he didn't. He came into the world to reveal his father. He did what his father told him to do. And this appears to be the way that Isaac conducted himself. He didn't have to live up to his father. He was able to be his own man and rightly reflect godly ways and values in his own life, and to carve out his own territory. And he was perfectly happy with that. He was perfectly happy with that. You know, might we say, laughing. This is smiling. This is what God has given me, and I'll make the most of it. I don't have to be my dad. I don't have to supersede him in any way. And the thing is, we learn about something interesting about Abraham and Isaac. Let's go to Genesis chapter 18, verse 19. Genesis 18, verse 19. Genesis 18, verse 19. As you think about you know, a father has a responsibility to teach his son. And look at what Abraham did here, Genesis 18, verse 19. It says, "For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him." So Abraham taught his children. And the beautiful thing about Isaac is that Isaac learned the lessons well. You know, do you respect your father? Then you would learn the lessons and take to heart the lessons that have been imparted to you. Isaac did what Abraham said. Now let's go to Genesis chapter 26. Genesis chapter 26. Did Isaac learn the lessons of his father? This is one illustration here in dealing with a particular challenge in his time. Genesis chapter 26, verse 1. "There was a famine in the land, besides the first famine, and this that was in the days of Abraham." And what happened in that first famine? Abraham went down to Egypt. Okay, so that's how Abraham dealt with it. "And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar." So he lived in Isaac lived in the area around Beersheba, which is pretty hot and dry, and there was a famine, so conditions had deteriorated. And the fact that he moved to Gerar tells you that he was probably beginning to run low on supplies, so they had to move to a place where land to graze the cattle and sheep and all of that was more available, and so they moved to Gerar, closer to the coast. "Then the Lord appeared to him and said, 'Do not go down to Egypt. Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father.'" So if you're in the condition that Isaac and his household was in, it would have been wise from a human perspective to move to Egypt. And God said, "No, I don't want you to go down to Egypt. I don't want you to stay where you're at in Gerar." And he said, "I will bless you. I will be with you and bless you." Now, based upon the conditions that were to be found at that time, it didn't seem like a wise move. So God said, "Stay where you're at." He says in verse 4, "And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven, and I will give your descendants all these lands, and your seed and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So he's making him a wonderful promise. And he cites the obedience of his father Abraham. And Abraham had taught Isaac well. When God tells you to do something, then do it. Don't follow your human nature. Do what God tells you to do. It may not make sense from a human perspective, but do what God tells you to do. So then we see a simple statement in verse 6, which tells us what Isaac's approach was. So Isaac dwelt in Gerar. Isaac dwelt in Gerar. He did what God said. He went against what everybody else was doing. He went against what his own nature was telling him to do. And in this we see Isaac's outstanding characteristic: trustful, faithful submission to God. He trusted God, he was faithful to God, and he submitted to God. Now let's go to Genesis chapter 31. And Genesis 31 speaks of another of the patriarchs, but it does give us some insight into Isaac. We're probably all familiar with the story of Jacob and his having to go to the land that his of the family had originated from, and he went back there to because Esau was going to kill him, and he ends up in Laban's household. And he bargains with Laban for Rachel and ends up with Leah, and then has to work longer for Rachel. And then he picks up a couple of handmaidens on the way, and he goes through all of the ups and downs in the household of Laban. And Laban is a conniver, and so is Jacob. But Jacob met his match in conniving with Laban. And Laban rolled him in a number of different times. And finally he said, you know, the only way we're going to get out from under this is to leave. So he eventually says, we got to go. And so they load up the household and they take off, and Laban catches up with them. So there's quite a heated confrontation going on there. But eventually they enter into a covenant. Laban is going to allow them to leave, and God has intervened here to help Laban see, you don't want to touch this guy. I'm with this guy, so leave him alone. So, okay, we'll leave him alone. So they enter into a covenant. And what's said here is what's interesting in helping to formulate this covenant and to agree to it. Let's go to Genesis chapter 31, verse 42. Here it says, unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac. So this is Jacob, Abraham's grandson, Isaac's son, using this terminology. He said, unless the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. So we see here Abraham, he cites the God of Abraham, but he calls God the fear of Isaac. And then let's go down to verses 51 through 53. Then Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap and here is this pillar which I have placed between you and me. This heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness, and I will not pass beyond this heap to you. You will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. Then the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. He swore by the fear of his father Isaac. So what we see in verse 42 and in verse 53 is the word fear is put in the place of God. In other words, the fear of Isaac was God. And God inspired Jacob to use Isaac's outstanding characteristic, the fear of God. So who is the fear of God? It was Abraham's God, but expressed in Isaac's life by the right and proper fear that he had for God. So we see here that obviously in Jacob's life, he has seen the way that his father had conducted himself. He saw that he always operated in fear of God. And so Isaac's fear of God was something that he was recognized for. His own son saw it. And it had made such an impression on him that he referred to God as the fear of Isaac. So this fear of God had wonderful results because this was one wise man. He knew what to do in almost any situation like his father. And he would almost invariably do the right thing because he had that right fear of God. His faith in God was expressed by the deepest of respect. He had deep respect and he considered God at all times in everything that he did. We saw it in the instance of his staying in Gerar. Said, okay, God told me to stay here, then I guess I should stay here. And he willingly submitted to God to do what God asked him to do. So Isaac took God seriously in every aspect of his life. He learned what his father Abraham taught him very well. And this approach netted wonderful results in Isaac's life. Wonderful results. So let's go to Psalm 34. Psalm 34, this makes note of something. It's a reference back to the sermon on the fear of God. The fear of God is not a natural thing. It is not a natural thing. It is something that is learned. And and David makes reference to this in Psalm 34. Psalm 34, verse 11, it says, "Come, you children, listen to me." So David, as the writer here, says, "Come and listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." It's something that you have to be taught and you have to learn. We all do. It's part of the process we're going through now in this life, to learn the fear of the Lord. Verse 12 goes on to say, "Who is the man who desires life and loves many days that he may see good?" Who doesn't want many days? Doesn't want a long life and all the blessings that come with it? "Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace. Pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth." So what he's talking about in verse 11, he says, the fear of the Lord has to be learned. It's something we all learn. And the result is many days. And then he goes on to reflect about those things that show the right fear of God. And so all of the things that are described here follow on the heels of learning to fear fear God always. It's something that we have to learn, and hopefully we're all learning it, because it is most important to our future. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 8 and just look at one verse in Isaiah 8. Isaiah 8, verse 13. Verse 13 says, "The Lord of hosts, him you shall hallow. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread." You know, there's nothing that we should fear more than God. You know, as we've talked about in the past, he is a consuming fire. And so we have that right fear of God, realizing that he is our judge and the one that we have to answer to ultimately. And Isaac did this so well that the fear of God is what he became noted for, especially in his family. Isaac exemplified the fear of God to a very high degree. And he lived a long life as a result and had the results in his own life. And one of the things that we can conclude about Isaac when the whole picture comes together is that Isaac wasn't in competition with his dad or anybody else. He lived within himself, setting us an example that Christ exemplified when he came to the earth. Now let's think about Isaac's wife here for a while. The situation was that Abraham and Sarah eventually said, you know, we really don't want Isaac to marry in the Canaanites, which is indicative of the condition, the moral condition and religious condition of the Canaanites. He did not want Isaac to marry into that community because it would lead him astray. He wanted him to marry into a family that at least had some inkling of a knowledge of the true God. It was the family that Abraham had come from. And so what happened is, to find a wife, they sent Eliezer to back to the home territory there where the family was still residing in Haran. And so Eliezer goes, he takes a number of servants with him and camels and makes their way back to that area. He's looking for a wife for Isaac. Let's go to Genesis chapter 24, where it gives us more details about this. And it is a most interesting story. And, and you have to realize that Abraham's been praying about this. And Isaac's been praying about this. And a lot of people are very concerned about this, and God is very much involved here in working all of this out. So chapter 24, it talks about his coming to the place where this family lived, and Eliezer says, you know, if you're with me here, help things to work out. So he pulls up with his camels and was there at the time when the women normally came out to draw water. So he's there with his camels. It's been a long, hot, dusty day. And so out comes this woman and notices that he's there. And what does she do? She says, hey, you know, would you like me to draw water for your camels? And she does. She draws water for him, his camels, and takes care of this individual, which is probably indicative that this person has certain very positive qualities. There are people that probably would have said, you draw water for your own camels, buddy. I'm not going to do this for you. But she was willing to do it. And then she invited him to stay with them. And so he's asked God to help things to work out, and it works out to where he ends up with the very family that he was to look at as far as a wife is concerned. So let's go down to verse 61 of chapter 24. So Sarah has agreed to return to Mary, Abraham's son, and so they head out to to meet this individual. Verse 61, then Rebekah and her maids arose, and they rode on the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now Isaac came from the way of Beer Lahai Roy, for he dwelt in the south. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field in the evening, and he lifted his eyes and looked, and there the camels were coming. So he goes out and what's he doing? Meditating in the field. The word translated meditate means to bend down the mind, the body, both together. And God's point here is showing us that Isaac wasn't just doddering around, wasting his time, doing nothing. He was a pious man, and he regularly communicated with God, and it's very likely that he was praying about this very situation of this whoever would that God would bless them with the woman that would return with the servant, and that he would have a wife. And so he was consulting with the one who would be able to bring the right thing to pass at the right time. So Isaac looked beyond Abraham and the servant Eliezer. He looked to the one who controls all things. And he was undoubtedly turning these things over in his mind when Rebekah shows up, talking to God about it. And how old is he at this time? He's about 40. He's about 40 years of age. So he's no spring chicken. So he's 40. And as he goes on to say here that then Rebekah in verse 64 of Genesis 24, then Rebekah lifted her eyes when she saw Isaac. She dismounted from her camel, and she said to the servant, who is this man walking in the field to meet us? The servant said, it is my master. So she took a veil and covered herself, a display of respect. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. So his mother had died by this point, and Sarah was a very special person. And this woman appeared to be very much the match for Sarah. And he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So what we're looking at here is Isaac's fear of God and what the fear of God produced in a practical way. We can see that Isaac looked to God for the answer, and when God gave it, he accepted that. And as he looked at Rebekah, he said, you know, this is the whole package. And Sarah is mentioned in the chapter because Sarah was not just beautiful, but she was also the mother of the faithful, a type of the church. And Isaac took Sarah to his tent. And what's God telling us here? He's telling us that that Rebekah was every bit as much as Sarah. So he stayed with her. He was faithful to her throughout their entire marriage. I mean, he's 40 here. He dies at 180. So they had a long relationship. And what does it say about Rebekah? The servants fell in love with her right away. Besides that, where do we meet her in the story? At the well, drawing water. So she was a hard worker and taking care of the camels that were accompanying Eliezer. And Eliezer could tell right away that the person he had met at the well was special. She was a generous of spirit, hospitable, and on her own she invited him and his servants to her home. He was struck by her modesty. As we've seen here, she covered her face as a show of respect to the one who would be her husband. She was also decisive. Laban, the conniver, wanted Eliezer and his fellow servants to stay longer because he recognized, hey, these people are well-to-do. Because Eliezer had given some gold and other gifts to Rebekah. And they thought, hey, we can get a piece of this too. But he wanted him to stay longer, and Rebekah said, no, I'll go with him and we'll leave sooner than you would like us to. So it appears overall they had a wonderful marriage. They did have the challenge of disagreement on whose was which of the children was the favorite, but that was really not the paramount thing in their marriage relationship. So Rebekah was God's blessing to Isaac, as was Isaac a blessing to Rebekah. And the case was, and this was the case, because Isaac was submitted to God. Let's look at another situation here. Let's look at Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 12. And then we'll look at how Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 14. We'll look at Christ and then we'll look at Isaac and how he dealt with things. Matthew chapter 12, verse 14. So Christ had his hands full in dealing with the Pharisees. They didn't like what he was teaching. They didn't like his challenging them on some of their points of view. And so they were, needless to say, hostile to him. Matthew chapter 12, verse 14. Then the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might destroy him. So their goal was to destroy Jesus Christ. So what does Christ do? Now you have to realize, from our perspective, what would we expect? If people are threatening you, what do you do? You know, there is a school of thought, don't get mad, get even. So you know this is coming, so you take them out first. Do a preemptive strike. But how does Christ deal with them? You know, which is an example for all of us. He says, but when Christ knew it, and when Jesus knew it, he withdrew from there. So he didn't go confront them. He withdrew from there, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them. Yet he warned them not to make him known. He didn't want them to go out and spread it around, the miracles he was doing and what he was teaching, and because fame was not going to help the preaching of the gospel. In fact, it was going to make things more difficult. That it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will declare justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break. So a bruised reed is already weak, and if you put any pressure on it, it's going to break. And a smoking flax he will not quench. So a smoking flax is, yes, there's burning and smoke being given off, but it's just barely going. And if you do anything, you're going to put that flax out. Till he sends forth justice to victory in his name, Gentiles will trust. So we see here how Christ dealt with his those who were seeking his downfall. We see here that he did not seek fame, and we also see that his general demeanor was gentle. It was unassuming. It was retiring nature. It was not one to wrangle about or shout or get into battles with others. He was a bruised reed, and a smoking flax gives us an indication of Christ's approach. He treated people with genuine sympathy and tender concern, even though he knew they were out to get him. Now let's go to Genesis 26. Because that's where it talks about God telling Isaac to stay in Gerar. Stay in Gerar. Genesis chapter 26. So Isaac says, well, okay, we'll stay in Gerar, and despite the famine. And let's pick up the story beginning in verse 12. Genesis 26, verse 12. Then Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. The man began to prosper and continued prospering until he became very prosperous. So because of his fear of God, God prospered him. God blessed him. But what happened? For he had possessions of flocks and possessions of herds and a great number of servants, so the Philistines envied him. Hey, there's a famine in the land and this guy's prospering? How can that be? They envied him that all these positive things are happening to him. So, verse 15, now the Philistines had stopped up all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, and they had filled them with earth. So God's prospering Isaac, and so what do they do? Well, we'll take care of this guy. We'll stop his prosperity. We'll go ahead and foul all the wells. We'll plug them all up. And we'll see if he prospers. Now think about this we've all seen Westerns. Those times when you have the cowboys and the ranchers and all the battles they get into. So if you were a rancher, you're Isaac the rancher, and they stop up your wells, what are you going to do? Hey boys, it's time to mount up, get your guns. We're going to go take these guys out. Isn't that what human beings do? We'll stop their wells for them. But what does he do? God had blessed him. God had prospered him. And so they stop up all the wells. And verse 16, it says, and Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us, for you are much mightier than we. So he said, leave. Leave. So what does Isaac do? What does Isaac do? Verse 17, then Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. Okay, you want me to move? I'll move. So he moved to a different part of Gerar. He didn't leave the region, but he moved to a different part of it, to a valley. He didn't go fight them. And you have to realize that he had a household and he had plenty of men in his household that he could have formed into an army, and they could have said, we're not moving. We'll do battle with you if we have to. But he moved. He moved. So he didn't stay around and fight. He moved on. Verse 17. So then Isaac departed, and it shows a submission to God, that God's going to work this out. That God has some purpose afoot here that I can't necessarily see, but God is going to bless me. He promised me he would. So he moved, and we see that he did so in humility, rather than saying, you know, this is a dastardly deed and I'm not going to put up with it. He humbly moved on. Verse 18, and Isaac dug again the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. He called them by the names that which his father had called them. Also, Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found a well of running water there. So they moved to another location, less inhabited, and they dug another well. And as you think about that, do you think God was blessing him? It would certainly appear so. So then what happens? So God has blessed him, and he finds water and is able to take up residence there. Verse 20, but the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, the water is ours. So he called the name of the well Esek, because they quarreled with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that one also. So he called its name Sitna. And he moved from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he called its name Rehoboth, because he said, for now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land. Think about his disposition. If he hadn't had that particular disposition that is reflected in his name, Isaac, laughing, you think he would have dealt with it in this particular way? He feared God, and he moved on, and God made room for him. So he instead of saying, we're going to go out and fight this, we're going to go ahead and move, and God will work it out for us. And God did. God provided for him and made sure that he and his family were taken care of because he was following what God told him to do. So we won't read the rest of this, but ultimately the Philistines come to him and make covenant with him. And again, what would you have told those Philistines once they come to you and say, hey, let's make covenant? Wouldn't you have said, forget you. I'm not going to make a covenant with you guys the way you've treated me. But he did. And they had made a feast together and they departed in peace. And this was part of God's blessing upon the house of Isaac. So we can see in this situation why Isaac's name is so apropos, laughing. He laughed because of his fear of God, and he laughed because he knew his life was in God's hand. The fear of God was not just an idea, but the way that he lived. Let's think about the deception that took place. The deception that took place as far as the birthright when Rebekah and Jacob deceived him. Now, what they did was reprehensible. And once Isaac found out what they did, it said that he was trembled exceedingly. So I would venture to say he was angry, just shaking with anger. But the thing that we have to realize here is that he got over it quickly. He got over it quickly because it's likely that he quickly saw that God's hand was in what happened. He remembered back to the birth of his two boys. He remembered that God had said to Rebekah, the eldest will serve the younger. And even though he didn't agree with how it was done, he saw that God was in the picture. God was in the picture. And later on, even though Esau wanted a blessing, he said, I can't do it. The only blessing he could pronounce was that periodically Esau would break Jacob's yoke, but Jacob would keep on getting the upper hand. Now, the epitome of Isaac's submission to God is found in the situation where Abraham was asked to sacrifice him. He was most assuredly a type of Christ. And really, as you look at this, Isaac wasn't a little boy. Isaac was a grown man. Isaac was at least 25. And it's very possible, you know, since he was a type of Christ, could he have been 33? The Bible doesn't tell us. But he was at least 25. And most 25-year-olds would recognize that your father is walking to a place to make sacrifice. And you have wood, and you have everything else that goes along with the sacrifice, but no sacrifice. You'd probably know something's up here. Now, if he's 25 or 33, you don't think that he could outrun Isaac once he figures out what's going to happen and say, hey, not me. I'm not going to go through this. Isaac knew what was going to take place and he willingly submitted. And what he did was extraordinary. He knew that he was to be the sacrifice. And just as his father knew that God had the power to resurrect the dead, he knew that as well. And he submitted to God to do that. Submitted to God to make that sacrifice. Just exactly as Christ's ultimate sacrifice was an act of submission on his part. Isaac didn't just have faith in God, he feared him, and it was a positive fear. He was so sure that God was involved in his life that it drove him to do whatever God wanted. Isaac was a great man. And you know what the laughing indicates? It indicates peace. He was at peace within himself. He wasn't all bound up worrying about things. He wasn't anxious. He was content because of his fear of God. Because of that fear, he trusted God to take care of him. Isaac became a great man on his own through his fear of God. And as we look at Isaac, hopefully this gives you more insight into him and why he is one of the great men of the Bible. And hopefully we can follow Isaac's example in that God will be our fear as well. The fear of Isaac will be our God, and that we will follow his example of having that right fear of God. So hopefully this gives you some insight into the fear of God a little bit more, and hopefully we can learn from the example of Isaac as we deal with our challenges in our life. And hopefully it because he does set us a wonderful example.